Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I have the privilege of talking with current and former public servants to understand who they are, what shaped them, and why they chose a path of service. What's the point? We're connecting one human and one story at a time. We're revisiting why we chose careers in service and what that says about us, our families, our communities, and about America. We're not oversimplifying anything. We're not reducing things to sound bites. We're really just here to reflect on our own lives with honesty and curiosity. And this in itself is a radical act and exactly what we need. Today, I am here with Bill Russo. Bill has spent most of his career in government and politics, most recently as Assistant Secretary of State, leading the Bureau of Global Public Affairs for the Biden-Harris administration. With nearly 400 members on a team of communicators located around the world, the Bureau explains U.S. foreign policy priorities and tells the story of America. Bill previously served in government in a number of roles in the Obama administration from 2011 to 2017, in the office of the Vice President, at the National Security Council, and the State Department as well. In between stints in government from 2017 to 2021, he was the spokesperson for President Biden's personal office, where he helped execute the communications strategy that set Biden up for his successful campaign for the presidency. In that campaign, Russo served as the Deputy Communications Director for Press, overseeing a team of spokespeople who drove the campaign's narrative from the day that it was launched. I have been wanting to sit down and talk with him for a while, and I am so excited to have you here today, Bill. So thank you for being with me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I would love to jump right in and just understand a little bit more about what drove you to follow this path. Tell me about your family and your upbringing and kind of what mattered the most in your home when you were growing up.
No, I mean, that's absolutely the right place to start, because the journey from there to here has not necessarily been a linear one. But, you know, I really do trace it back to kind of the household I grew up in and kind of the expectations in that household, which were, you know, that we, you know, I grew up in a very, very loving family and a very loving household. And we were comfortable. We didn't want for anything. And so the expectation was that, you know, we had this incredible privilege and opportunity and we had to give back. And so, you know, whether that was scouts or community service through church, through school, you know, there was always an expectation on me to give back. And my parents led by example, on that. And so, you know, I think growing up in that atmosphere, when I then went off to college, I really thought, well, okay, how do I, and I was figuring out what I want to do professionally with my life. How do I continue to do this? How do I marry up this, you know, this call to service with, you know, the need to have a job and get a paycheck. And that's where the road starts to become a little bit windy, which is, you know, initially I was a psychology major because I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to med school. I'm going to be a psychiatrist. And that is how I'm going to help people, right? At the end of the day, it was like, I want to help people. And I thought, okay, this seems to me to be the way that I'm going to help people. And that lasted one psychology course, like intro to psychology. And I was like, this is absolutely not going to be my pathway to service.
What was so bad about that course?
And you know, the thing is, it's actually like, that isn't even the course that was designed to weed people out of the major. That came in the second semester. I don't even remember exactly what it was, but it was just a sense that like, actually this is just an overwhelming feeling that this is not for me. This isn't who I am. The kind of the idea of helping and serving was still very much what I wanted, but this particular pathway to service wasn't it. Yeah. But I had that second class, and it was like a research methods course or something like that. It was a mandatory class to take in the second semester. And so I was like, okay, I have to drop this major. I cannot fathom taking the second class that sounds way worse than this first one that has already made me decide I do not want to do this with my life. But so I couldn't just undeclare a major and just not have one. I had to swap it for something else. And that first semester, as one of my kind of broad electives, I'd taken a political science class. And I said, you know what? I like this. This is good, and this is interesting. And I also had the benefit of coming into college with a bunch of like AP credits, and so I was like, all right, I have time here. I don't need like I'm not going to be jammed to graduate on time. I'm going to have ample time. So great. I'm going to switch to political science. This will be interesting, and then I can do this while I figure out what it is I want to do when I grow up. And so I switched to political science and started taking more political science classes. And then like another semester later, I had taken a few English classes and I started looking. I was like, oh, I'm already halfway to an English major, so I'm going to add an English major, and that'll be good and helpful. People want writing skills. That sounds like a useful thing that I can translate. And so I'm going to do political science in English, and I'm going to do that while I figure out what it is that I want to do, what I really want to do for my career. And then I had like really I got a, I had like a color-coded spreadsheet going. I really started doing some planning. I was like, you know what? I could add a history major by only taking like two more extra classes. And I was like, okay, so I'm going to do this triple major, political science, history, and English, and I'm going to do this while I'm figuring out what it is that I want to do. And then, fast forward a little while, and then I'm graduating, and I'm like, okay, well, I have these majors, and I've maybe a little bit figured out what it is that I want to do. And the for me, the switch there flipped my junior year of college when I studied abroad. And I was in London. It wasn't like a massive cultural shift from being on the East Coast. But for some reason, just being immersed in another culture, being somewhere else, being a little, even a, just a little bit outside of my comfort zone was enough for me to be like, oh, this is part of what I want.
Yeah, you're like, more of this, more of this.
Yeah, like more of this. And I'd also started taking some international relations, international development courses, and I had a really incredible professor, Dr. Maloba. And I really started talking to him. I was like, I'm really interested in environmental policy. I'm really interested in an international bent and kind of international development. And I'm kind of really interested in the intersection of these two things. Like, what do you think I should do? And he was, he said to me, and he was originally from Kenya and had a strong political perspective on this. And he said, well, if you want to study international development, if you want to figure out how to fix things, you must go to where it was broken in the first place. You must go to a former colonial country. And so he was like, you should go to England. And so he was the one who steered me to going to the University of Sussex in Brighton, England for grad school, which also I was graduating college at like in the middle of the Great Recession, and so there were not particularly strong job prospects
Same,
anyway.
same. So I feel that, yes.
Yeah, and so like I get to the end of college and I'm like, okay, I don't really know what I want to do. I have an inkling of an idea. But now I'm going to go to grad school and see if I can kind of really nail down what this looks like. And so I went to grad school. I got my master's degree in environment development and policy. And so it was exactly this intersection of international development and environmental policy. And I had, again, kind of a path where I was like, okay, I'm gonna work in nonprofits or maybe in the UN system, going to do some, I'm gonna try and do some ground work on the ground, some relief and development work. And like by the time I was getting ready to graduate, I'd finished my coursework and I was working my thesis. I was like, okay, now I think I have an idea of what my path to service is gonna look like. But then, to borrow a Bidenism, reality has a way of intervening. And so I came back home to kind of just spend some time at home with my family during the summer while I was writing my thesis. And a week after I got back, my dad passed away. He'd had colon cancer for a number of years, and I kind of hadn't realized how sick he'd gotten. And so a week after I got back, my dad passed away, and my younger sister was in high school at the time. And so, I got an extension on my thesis, but I quickly realized like the whole plan of, living abroad and being abroad and kind of living this kind of globe-trotting life, actually wasn't going to happen, because what I really needed to do was to be at home and to be close to my family and to help out there. And so I was like, all right, I'd really thought I had a sense of where this was of kind of where my career path was going, and then I had to quickly change that again, and so I was at home for a while. I was helping out with my family. Eventually, one day, my mom came home from teaching, and I was still like on the couch in my pajamas watching Netflix, and I was like, okay, I really need to like start getting my life back together. And I took a job working at a Starbucks, but not like a regular Starbucks or a real Starbucks. It was a Starbucks inside of a Target.
Kind of like the Starbucks we had at the State Department in the basement, fake Starbucks. Yeah.
Exactly. So I was essentially working. I mean, I was like, I had gotten official Starbucks training, but I was technically a Target employee. Which basically just meant I couldn't take tips, which is kind of like the worst part
Bummer.
of,
Yeah.
right? Working in a barista job and not getting any tips was kind of defeating the purpose of it. And so like I kind of felt like I was like, okay, this feels like a low. Where do I go from here? And so I was like, I still had this policy interest. I still had like the things I was interested in hadn't changed. The geography of it had changed a bit. And so I started kind of focusing a little bit more on Washington, D.C. And I'd applied for a number of jobs on the Hill. I'd applied at a consulting company. And at one of my friend's recommendations, I'd also applied for the White House internship program because I figured, I was just at this point where, I'm sure many people who have, maybe even, who have just come out of the administration or otherwise, are just, sending out, or certainly kids graduating college these days are just, sending out what feels like an endless number of applications and resumes into what
Into the
feels like
abyss.
just, yeah, just a black hole, where, maybe you get a response every once in a while. And so it was like I was at this point where I was like, okay, like I had charted out this path to a career in service. I had like had a few different ideas, but like I'm back at home, I have a master's degree, I'm working at a Starbucks inside of a Target. Where do I go from here? And then like in one like 3 day period, it kind of all quickly shifted. Because on a Thursday, I heard that like this consulting job in DC that I had interviewed for offered me the position on Thursday, and it was like entry level, like I think like $35,000 a year, which in DC I actually like even then I'm not entirely sure how I would have been able to live on it, but I was like, okay, I have a paying job and this is gonna be my path. And I stalled. I was like, as a negotiating tactic, I was like, let me, I have some other things I'm considering. Let me get back to you, beginning of next week. But I was gonna like use that as like a leverage tactic to try and get like a few more dollars out of them. And then I heard the next day from the White House that I had gotten this White House internship, and suddenly I was faced with this like incredible opportunity, but also incredible conundrum between, do you take an unpaid internship that is just, has this incredible opportunity, or do you take the paying job that's, a little bit more stable if underwhelming? And basically this to me was like the in hindsight, the biggest decision that I've made professionally, which is that I chose the White House internship. I chose to kind of take a bet on myself. And it was, and you know, I it was I was lucky to get to have gotten the offer at any point in time, but the fact that I had that sharp decision to make, I think actually also made the internship so much more powerful because I knew what I was giving up to take it. And so when I hit the ground in August of 2011 for the internship, I was like, I have to make this work for me. I have to like I am not like no one is going to work harder than me. No one's going to like I'm going to get the most I possibly can out of this opportunity. And so that is ultimately, what set me down the path. I, had the White House internship. I got hired a few months afterwards in the office of the vice president, in an administrative role, but then moved over to the national security team when Jake Sullivan became the national security advisor. They moved over to the National Security Council. It was the first time I worked for Tony Blinken. And then he got confirmed as Deputy Secretary of State, and so went over to the State Department with him for the first time. And then, was off to the races. And so it was never that was not a particular linear path to doing it, but ultimately a very fulfilling one. And ultimately, I feel like I met the expectation that I had for myself, and again, that I kind of grew up with, which was, how can I use my time and my talents to make the world a better place and to leave to do a little good and leave the place a little bit better than I found it.
That piece resonates with me so much, and I think every public servant that I've ever talked to has said the same thing, some version of that. I think that's what pulls us to the work. And I also think we're at a moment where people are being forced maybe to question where they actually are going to do that good. And that has not just something to do with politics, but with your own background and what opportunities exist around you, and kind of things are always changing. And it's a question I asked myself a lot, especially when I chose to leave the State Department last year. I was asking myself the question, where do I feel like I can do the most good with what I have available to me? And it's not a simple answer, but I think it's super cool that you, it sounds like you have trusted your gut at many kind of pivotal junctures in your life. I mean, your gut led you to leave that terrible psych major. Your gut kind of led you to go overseas and to kind of feel your way to the right path for you, rather than kind of just making an intellectual choice. Like, you tried things out and you felt what fit. And then making the choice when you came back to spend some time with your family, be there for them at a moment that felt really important for you and for your family, I imagine, to be together. And on the subject of your family for a second, are you the oldest child?
Oh, yeah.
I had a hunch because I'm a fellow oldest child. It's obvious.
Am I giving strong first child
yes,
vibes?
You are, but I'm a fellow oldest child, so I mean it in a good way. It was the spreadsheets that tipped me off.
Yeah.
When you mentioned the color-coded spreadsheets, I was like, oldest kid. So I also understand that sense of responsibility that you must have felt. And I also think oldest kids make really great leaders. So I'm just going to say it. My sister is a public servant as well, and I hope to have her on the podcast later. So we'll ask what she thinks about that. But in the meantime, since it's my show.
always good to have dissenting views, but yes, in this case, yes, fully agreed.
The statement stands. So then, thank you so much for sharing that story. It's really interesting. I love the fact that you had so many twists and turns. And I'm wondering now, because you just told us your story, what do you think is the role of storytelling in not only kind of building campaigns or advancing U.S. foreign policy, but also just in fortifying our democracy?
You know, it's been something I've been thinking about a lot. I mean, it's something that was obviously, you know, part of my day-to-day work throughout so much of my time in government and politics, but something I've been thinking about a lot since I've left, and I've been thinking a lot lately, you know, because you look in the news and you look at some of the things that are happening in the world. And so, you know, for instance, you know, you look at, you know, the rise of anti-Semitism happening around the world, and you have to wonder, you know, this can't simply be a coincidence that it's happening at a time when the generation that survived, that lived through and survived the Holocaust, is mm-hmm. is dying off. You know, you look at, you know, questions around the rise of fascism in different parts of the world, and you think, well, that can't necessarily be a coincidence that it's happening at a time when, you know, the last few who fought in World War II. Are dying off, and you can kind of look and see at a bunch of different things that in some ways feel cyclical, but also feel linked to this loss of people who had the first person experience going through it and who could tell us stories from their own perspective about what they lived through, and that maybe those stories, those powerful first person stories, were the things that helped keep those bad things at bay for as long as they did. And so on one hand, it's, you know, I think it speaks to the power of storytelling in not only, you know, shaping our views of the world, but shaping, you know, our policies, to your point, our democracies, the way things actually, you know, play out in our day-to-day lives. But then it's also kind of the power of the absence, right? And in some ways the limits of stories, right? Because the stories of those people still live on. We have books and films and oral histories. We know what happened in the early and middle parts of the 20th century, but it's just not quite as powerful reading about it, seeing mm-hmm. it on a screen. There's something about actually, you know, either sitting down or just hearing directly from someone who lived it.
Yeah.
That I think is, outweighs anything else that we can really do to tell those stories. And so I think it's to me it's both sides of the coin. It demonstrates the power of storytelling in shaping our world, but also the limits. And in some ways the limits get to the power of actual human connection. And that, you know, we need moments like this for people to actually have the opportunity to share their own stories in ways that connect and hopefully reach, you know, deep, not just into people's minds, but kind of deep into their hearts. I really do think, you know, that telling stories that are authentic and true and human, can change the world, can change people's minds, can change the policies and the, even again, the kind of ability to have freedom and live in a democracy that we do. I worry about, the kind of loss of history. And then, a little, and then the other part of it is, of course, the kind of the fractured media environment that we live in, right? Even if you have these incredible personal stories, how do you actually reach people with them when we're all so distracted because we have phones, we have, a million different apps to watch. There's entertainment out there, and news, the kind of traditional sources of getting this information is incredibly in decline. So how do we flip that a little bit and to reach people where they are in a meaningful way with stories that really affect change? Again, it's I think there's such tremendous power and opportunity, but I'm also concerned looking out at the challenges we face and actually kind of reaching people with those stories.
Yeah, and I think, sometimes asking the questions is more important than having the answers. And I think you're asking all the right questions. And it is such a challenging environment because, like you said, breaking through, even if you have a great story to tell, can be so challenging. And we're also distracted and we're being conditioned not to ever really focus deeply on anything. And so I think, there's a lot to unpack there in terms of human psychology. So maybe you should have gone for that degree after all. Maybe you'll circle back.
I was just going to say, it's all coming full circle.
It is. But I mean, really, that's the thing that interests me so much is like, I got into public service because I'm interested in systems, but fundamentally, I'm really interested in human beings and how humans interact with those systems. And so I'm kind of always pulled between these two worlds of wanting to do something small but impactful, or wanting to fix something enormous that has the ability to affect the most people, but is also like the most challenging to change. So, I've just tried to do both and had sleepless nights, but I don't know. I don't know what you recommend.
No, I mean, you're totally right. It's like, the most powerful conversations are the kind of one-to-one human conversations. But, at like what, 7 billion human beings, one-to-one doesn't necessarily scale. And so how do you tap into the power of stories, the power of human interaction, the power of those kind of almost intimate conversations in a way that does scale? I mean, like that to me is as a communicator is like is really the big question for this moment right now. But I think certainly for public servants, former or current, for people who care about public service and democracy and our institutions, that's also that's a big challenge for all of us to kind of figure out how we do effectively. And I think part of it is trying a whole lot of different things and seeing what works and making investments of whether of time, of money, of attention, into the ones that do.
And to come back to the point that you made about storytelling and about kind of just the loss of a whole generation of people that were able to tell these powerful stories that kind of prevented the recurrence of some of these issues that we're now seeing coming back. It makes me think about the first public servant and the best storyteller I have ever known was my grandfather, and he served in World War II. And I think he only had like maybe like a, he was up to like his sophomore year of high school and education, maybe. I don't even know if he graduated high school, but he was one of those people who was a lifelong learner and kind of self-taught through books and had tons of opinions on all different things. And one of the things that he treasured the most, in addition to like telling a totally outrageous story, which was probably exaggerated now that I think about it, one of the things he treasured the most was like his own independent point of view. And I think he raised kids who then also raised kids and built a whole family culture where we kind of resist surrendering our independent point of view. So we're all a little irreverent. That's my family culture. And I mean, honestly, it's a blessing and a curse. But I think storytelling plays a big role in that because it's part of shaping and articulating your point of view. And I think holding on to that as kind of the gift that it is, and not allowing anyone else to tell you you have to fit into this narrative box or this political box or that, is really kind of where we need to go with maybe rebuilding some of the torn fabric of our society. Do you know what I mean?
No, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, look, I think so much of the reason for our society or others that are feeling torn apart is the absence of human connection, you know, and whether that is because of the internet, whether that is because of COVID, whether that is because of ideology, you know, ideology and tribalism. I mean, I think there are probably at least five different reasons for that, all of which in some ways are kind of self-reinforcing, radicalizing, you know, it kind of creates a vicious cycle. And so, you know, addressing any one of them is probably not going to solve the problem. We have to kind of address all of them. But like, this is why actually I really, you know, in terms of like great public servants, I really thought Dr. Murthy, the former Surgeon General, you know, going out and talking about the kind of epidemic of loneliness was such a powerful thing to me, because you know, yes, it speaks to all of us on a human level, but you know, even kind of in the foreign policy world as a communicator, you know, I can see so many of the problems that I'm trying to deal with in terms of reaching people where they are, connecting with people, changing minds, you know, is probably in some ways downstream from that loss of connection and connectivity and community that he was talking about. And there are others too, you know, Senator Murphy from Connecticut, I know has written about it quite a bit as well. But you know, but that to me is a core part of the problem. And so then, okay, well then if loneliness is part of the problem driving all of these, you know, so many or exacerbating so many of these downstream issues, then connectivity, you know, human connection has to be part of the solution. And you know, storytelling to me is the most, you know I don't know that my family heritage was quite as maybe as irreverent, but was certainly, you know, like I just have so many, you know, so many visions of like family get-togethers of like just big belly laughs, telling stories about, you know, of you know, the time the family did this, relatives did that, in ways that, you know, those memories have stuck with me so much more than, you know, kind of other like data points or academic elements of my life that have, you know, kind of faded into the background. It's the human stories. It's the joy that comes from sharing them that has kind of stuck with me. And so I really think, you know, storytelling and human connection has to be at the heart of how we try and fix so many of these big systemic problems, because at the end of the day, you know, again, if the disconnect is what's driving it, that's the only antidote.
Yeah. So then you talked about family. Can you tell me a little bit about, I know that you made the decision, I think in 2024, that you were going to take a step back or a pause from your career and spend some time with your family. Can you tell me about that decision?
I'm now a sabbatical evangelist. You know, so in, so my older son, I have a 4-year-old, was born in 2021. And so was born, you know, right after I had kind of started this most recent stint in government, was kind of, you know, at the peak of, COVID. You know, we were still very, very, very isolated. And you know, a combination of all of those things, you know, I took parental leave, and I didn't necessarily take the maximal amount of it, but I for all of those reasons, it kind of didn't feel terribly present. And so when we knew our daughter was coming, the combination of that plus just, you know, it had been a long 13 years, right, from that White House internship, you know, that was kind of, I've had an incredible, you know, it was like hopping on the side of a rocket ship. I've been incredibly fortunate. I was incredibly lucky with the various, you know, turns and opportunities that came up in my career. But the downside of it was that it was grueling. It was exhausting, you know, a lot of jobs that required kind of being on 24/7, always being in contact. And I knew I was tired. I knew I was a little bit gassed. I don't think I actually fully realized the extent to which I'd been kind of burnt out until I actually did step back. But coming into 2024, you know, I knew that for me, for my family, and eventually kind of for the long-term career, it was time to take a little bit of a step back. And that was really hard because I was in my dream job, or actually, assistant secretary wasn't even my dream job because I'm not sure I was ever really audacious enough to dream that I would get that job. But once I did, it was, you know, it was that was to me was the top of the mountain. And so to finally get there, you know, initially I thought, you know, you will have to pry me out of here with, like, you know, the jaws of life. But, you know, it came up in this moment where I actually said, no, actually, like, I, you know, it's the best thing for me is to take a step back right now. The best thing for my family is for me to take a step back right now. And then the other part of it was, and it was maybe the harder part to admit, was that, you know, I think actually for my team, for the bureau, for the department, it was the best thing for me to step back and give them a chance to kind of have someone who was going to be fully focused, fully dedicated, on the job. During, you know, what I knew was, regardless of the actual results of the election, was still going to be a very transitory time there, and there was just a lot of important work to get done. And so, you know, made the hard decision to kind of step back, and so I left a week before my daughter was born, and had one whole week of time to, like, do a bunch of projects around the house before we suddenly had a baby in it. But then it was, you know, it was not quite a year. I'd initially planned on it being 5 or 6 months, and then I got to the 5 or 6 month point and realized that I still had many layers of the burnout onion left to peel. But, you know, in terms of getting to spend that time with my family, particularly our newborn daughter, it was the most incredible experience I've had. It was also really great for me to have a little bit of space to really think and process, you know, that time that I had spent, what I had loved about it, what I had accomplished, what I still, you know, what's still on my list of things to accomplish, and, you know, what kind of where I want to go next. But it also gave me some time. Like, you know, I wrote an essay on parenthood. And then, like, I had struck up this kind of pen pal relationship with an editor of the newspaper that published it, who also himself is a, you know, a writer of essays, many of which are on parenthood, and who, you know, I had kind of actually who had really kind of influenced and helped, his writings had really helped me kind of figure out how to be a dad. And, you know, I wrote it and I sent it to him because I wanted his feedback. And actually, the initial version of it was much more kind of about the ways in which his writings had also helped me kind of navigate the more difficult times of being a dad. And he was like, look, I can't publish an essay that's, like, you know, about me, but he's like, I think there's something here. I would really love for you to go back and publish it. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, I hadn't really intended on this living out in the world, but sure. And so, like, that to me was, like, you know, like, I never would have had the time or space necessarily absent this kind of sabbatical to really not only think about, you know, what it was that I wanted to say, but actually to kind of sit down and write it out in a way that I felt good about. And so, yeah. I mean, the sabbatical was just a really incredible time to be at home, to be present, but also to do a lot of thinking about kind of, okay, you know, what does the next chapter of life look like? And it kind of goes back to those fundamental questions that I was, you know, dealing with when I was, you know, starting in college, or when I was kind of coming out of grad school, which was, look, my North Star hasn't changed, right? I still want to find ways to do good, to serve. And I've had this incredible run doing that in government and politics. What does that look like somewhere else? What does that look like in another sector? And, like, that was not a there's not a readily apparent answer to that question for me. And so to have the time and space to really think about it in a kind of meaningful, deep way, I'm hugely grateful for.
Yeah, and also to think about what does that mean within your own family too, because we don't operate in isolation. So, everything that you're choosing is in conversation with what your partner needs, what your kids need. And that's a lot to juggle. So I imagine that like none of these decisions came very easily and were probably a part of a lot of conversations. If I don't know if I'm projecting, but I imagine there were a lot of conversations and negotiations. And I think it's really cool that you took the time to explore that, and we could do a whole other episode or like series of episodes on parenthood and what we learned from parenthood in our careers and on fatherhood and how that experience shapes you, because I think right now, like you mentioned, the loneliness epidemic. I think it affects men and women differently. And I think it affects men more acutely. And I've observed even just through my husband's journey in fatherhood that sometimes it can be kind of lonely or isolating if you don't have other men that you can share that experience with. And so now I'm like all about building community and figuring out how we can do that on a small scale and then on a bigger scale. But I think you're living it. And it's really cool to see yet another moment where you trusted your gut. And I think it seems like it's been really rewarding for you.
No, absolutely. And you're right about the gut. I mean, I at one point, I was talking to some college students and I was actually trying to like, I was trying to go back and look at like, you know, yes, the decision to drop psychology, the decision to pursue this first internship I had in college where I was 19 and got put on a campaign and was kind of ended up running the day-to-day communications, mm-hmm. which is kind of what, you know, what kind of got me in the communications side of the communications and foreign policy part of my career. I started adding up all of these kind of like little inflection points where I'd made a decision, and there were like 7 or 8 of them. And in each of the cases, I mean, I'm sure that making a different decision would have maybe opened up other doors and other opportunities. And, you know, I could have had a great career if I had gone down one of those other paths. But, you know, to me, it feels like I've basically won 8 straight coin tosses. and I know the odds of that are, you know, infinitesimally small. but in so many ways, that's really what it feels like. And you're totally right. I mean, it's been trusting my gut.
Yeah.
Some of it's been luck. Some of it's been luck that I've made. Some of it's been hard work. But it really does kind of feel at this moment that, you know, the opportunities that I've had to serve, the opportunities to do the work that I've done, to learn from the people, the mentors that I've had and the people that I've been able to learn from. I mean, it really feels like, I'm not actually a mathematician, so I don't actually know what the odds of winning 8 straight coin tosses are, but like, I have to imagine it's at least 1 in 1,000,000.
You're not a mathematician or a psychologist. However,
no,
I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit though, because like I heard this a long time ago, like you can either, people try to focus on making the right decision, but you can also focus on making the decision right. And I think that's what you've done. I think you made some good decisions, but I think you also made some choices that like maybe weren't panning out initially. You were spending a bit much time watching Netflix for a little while there, and then you turned it into something good. And I think that takes some grit and some passion. So I really admire that. And I have one more question for you, because I love to end on a really positive note. Who inspires you?
I mean, oh man, talk about things that we could have an entire, you know, episode based around. I mean, in my personal life, you know, my wife inspires me, you know, seeing the way that she shows up for our family, for our friends, the way that she's shown up professionally and been incredibly hardworking throughout her life and her career. You know, you talk about, you know, making the decision right. Well, like if I have motivation to put in the work to make things pan out, it's because I don't want to look bad when compared to the effort that my wife puts into everything that she does. So that's, you know, that's a huge source of inspiration. You know, my kids too, in part because, you know, I'm inspired by like the curiosity that they view the world with each and every day, and that, you know, reminds me to be curious, reminds me not always to be cynical. And I know that can be particularly hard these days. But you know, I admire the way that they demonstrate perseverance and curiosity throughout each and every day. And then professionally, I've had, you know, a lot of, I've had the benefit of working for some truly incredible people and truly incredible public servants, people like Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Joe Biden. But there are two people kind of particularly thinking about this last chapter of my career that I'm really fortunate to have had this kind of chance to learn from and who I admire incredibly. And, you know, one of them is John Bass, who for most of my last time at State was Undersecretary for Management and then kind of took over the political affairs portfolio, but is someone who, you know, has demonstrated an incredible commitment to service, has demonstrated, you know, has, you know, a courageous commitment to service throughout his career, but who also in meetings big and small, in ways big and small, always would root our conversations in kind of the humanity of the people that we worked for and worked with, right? Not every, if there is a conversation about the politics of the budget and the way things are moving on the Hill, he was always, rooting it in the concerns and anxieties of the workforce, would always, make, and if we were talking about, the civil service and foreign service workforce, then he would also make sure that we were thinking about eligible family members and local staff on the ground. Like just someone, a leader, who really modeled servant leadership and who always rooted it in the humanity of the people that we worked with and worked for. And so to see someone at such a high level who had had such, a storied career, but who never kind of lost touch with people who in some cases were like 8 levels below him in the State Department hierarchy. That I really admired that, and I was always really inspired by that. And then the other person was Julieta Noyes, who most recently was Assistant Secretary for PRM, Population, Refugees, and Migration. But I actually had the first, I had the fortune of meeting Julieta like a decade ago when she was the Deputy Assistant Secretary covering, I think, Eastern Europe, right when I'd first gotten into the State Department. I was a junior staffer working for then Deputy Secretary Blinken. And we were on, it was, I mean, I'd literally been at the department for a month. I was junior staffer. It was the first trip that we had done. We were traveling. I think we started the day in Berlin, and we were going to Moldova and ending in Ukraine. And I was getting on the plane right at the beginning of the trip, and the pocket in my suit jacket got caught on something, and I was kept walking forward, and it just like ripped right down the side,
Oh
and like
no.
my the pocket on my suit jacket was just kind of like flapping in the breeze and hanging out. And I was like, I'm here representing the United States, the State Department. I can't be going into these meetings and foreign ministries and presidencies, looking like I belong in Oliver Twist. And so I was like, oh, like this is like, oh, this is so embarrassing for me. I'm embarrassing my boss. I'm embarrassing the department. I was like, I kind of quickly was like, this is the worst thing ever. And we had this like hour and a half plane ride, and Julieta like saw and was like, oh, let me see this for a minute. And over the course of the hour and a half ride, had like pulled a sewing kit out of her purse and was like quickly mending the suit. And it wasn't just that someone who was, a deputy assistant secretary was doing this for someone who was, a junior staffer. It was that also that while she was doing this, she was seamlessly briefing on like the finer points of Moldova and Ukrainian politics and doing all of this. And I was incredibly impressed by the confluence of the two things, that like the kind of the selflessness and willingness to pitch in, even on something as, as minor and mundane as, as helping this guy out who'd gotten a rip in his suit. But also I was like, wow, I want to be as good at my job someday as she is, where I can do my job while I'm sewing, not looking at any notes, and like and still be that great. And so like that, like I admired, like from that moment on, I was a fan. I was all in on anything that she was doing, because I was just so incredibly impressed, and by like her character, but also her skill and professionalism. And so then, I was really lucky to have the chance to then, when I came back, get to serve with her again. And so, I think, the thing that strikes me is just like, these are just two people in a large organization that I just happened to get to spend a lot of time with by nature of my job. And I can just only imagine that, if there were 300 people I got to spend a lot of time with over the course of those years, and a small number of them were truly incredible, multiply that out by the size of the State Department's workforce, multiply that out by the size of the broader, federal government workforce, multiply that out and to include other public servants and state and local governments and elsewhere. And I just have to imagine, like, the number of truly incredible, dedicated, wonderful people has to be, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. I'm like, what an incredible resource. What an incredible, what an incredible group of people who I admire, even if I haven't met them yet, because I'm sure that they are doing the things that I've seen John Bass do, that I've seen Julieta Noyes do, that I've seen other people do in places that I'm just not present in. And so, I think I admire them too, even if I just haven't met them yet.
Isn't it amazing also what things stick in our mind that kind of just tell us something about a person? That, again, is like the humanity aspect, the connection aspect. That meant something to you. And there are little things that we're doing every day that hopefully are having that impact on somebody else too, right?
Yeah. And it's so funny because like when I came back and I saw Julia and I was meeting, you know, she remembered me and she remembered that trip. She did not at all remember the suit coat
Oh,
portion
really?
of that. She had completely, no, because if to her it was like, oh yeah, well you had a rip in your jacket and I
Yeah.
sewed it up. Like, why is that something I would remember? But it was like, I think she was kind of surprised the impact that it had left on me.
Yeah. So you never know how you're affecting somebody else. And that's why we got to just be kind as much as possible.
And we got to try.
Yes, we have to try. I feel like that's a perfect note to wrap this up on. It's so positive. But I really just want to thank you for sitting down and spending this time talking with me today. And I also really want to genuinely thank you for your service. I feel the same way. I never had the chance to work closely with you while we were both in government, but I am glad to know that you were there. And I can only imagine the number of people that you impacted with your, not only your competence, but your kindness. And so thank you for your service and thank you for hanging out with me today.
Oh, well, that is too kind. I'm not, if
it's
I
just
have,
the right
if
amount
I
of kind.
If I have a number of skills, one of them is not, taking compliments. I'm very bad at that. But I'm hugely grateful to you for the work that you're continuing to do. You know, talk about finding ways to serve, outside of, you know, the more traditional roles and clearly defined roles. You know, doing this is an incredible service, to those of us who have served and hope to once again. But of course, I still think to those who are still doing so today. So thank you.
Thank you.